Hello, and welcome to Banking Transform, the top podcast in retail banking. I'm your host, Jim Roos, owner and CEO of the Digital Bank Report and co-publisher of the Financial Brand. In September of 2020, we interviewed Colin Walsh just after Varo became the first challenger bank to receive a national bank charter. So much has happened in the banking industry and the economy in the past 2 years, even more so in the past week or so, impacting both traditional and non-traditional financial institutions. After a major funding round last year, Varo made a number of major changes to respond to competitive and marketplace challenges, including a reduction in marketing expense and staff, a refocus on product innovation, and a focus on existing customer engagement. We're revisiting Colin Walsh, founder and CEO of Varo, on the Banking Transform podcast. In this episode, Walsh discusses the opportunities and challenges that Varo has faced and provides insight into the future of Varo and other digital banks in a world disrupted by recent events at Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and the economy overall. So welcome back to the show, Colin. You know, it seems like so long ago since you were on the show, with the pandemic dominating our collective senses well into 2021. And now the economic uncertainty and certainly the recent news around the stability of the banking industry overall becoming growing concerns. So as I said almost 3 years ago, receiving a charter does not guarantee success, but it does differentiate Varo from formidable competitors such as Chime, Current, SoFi, and other fintech firms in the space. Looking back, was getting a charter the right decision?
Well, first off, Jim, great to be back on the show and great to have the opportunity to talk with your listeners. So yes, when we rewind back to our conversation 2.5 years ago, and we had literally just received our charter. We got the final approval in August of 2020, and I believe you and I chatted in September 2020. Yep. And so now, as I can look with a little bit of hindsight, I would say 100% it was the right thing to do. And if you look at the events that have been unfolding most recently, when you think about what matters, whether it doesn't really matter of the wealth or income brackets, what matters is safety and security, and that folks feel that their money is protected. And if I look at our situation right now, in the middle of all of this, you know, the vast majority of our deposits, over 90% of our deposits, are sitting at the Federal Reserve. I mean, can't really get any safer than that. And we haven't done risky things. We've got a small, very short duration investment portfolio. So there's really no risk in that. And we do not bank ultra high net worth individuals or businesses that could move their money on a tweet. And we've been focused for these last 2.5 years on designing a product that is meant to help improve the lives of the hardworking American. And right now, they can be assured that their money is safe with Varo. We're a direct member of the FDIC. We're regulated by the OCC, and we've taken very prudent decisions and built a very effective risk management program to make sure that we protect our customers. So if I think about like now being a bank and the things that we can do, and we'll talk a lot more about that and kind of what that journey has been, I think it was absolutely the right decision, and I think it's only going to continue to help Varo stand out in the crowd over time.
You know, obviously the economy has been a challenge to all fintech players and banks alike. There's also been talk across the fintech space as to the ability to withstand the lack of revenue and funding options, probably more today than even a week ago. These challenges may or may not have been exacerbated by the events around Silicon Valley Bank. What are the implications at Varo Bank and for the broader banking industry based on the Silicon Valley Bank situation?
Well, as you and I have talked about before, at the heart of the system is trust and this ability to feel your money is safe and protected. And as we think about how do you generate revenue, how do you manage in a rising rate environment, in uncertain economic conditions, I mean, it all boils down to, and this has been the heart of our business model from the beginning, is building those trusted primary relationships with consumers so that, you know, and we're dealing with hardworking everyday Americans that are trying trying to make ends meet. You know, many of our customers would only dream of having more than $250,000 to have in the bank. And so it is about creating the platform where folks can solve everyday problems. And for us, it's about helping manage cash flow. It's about helping speed up payments. It's around helping build savings. And in many instances, it's small dollar savings. But just to create that backstop, it's helping to give access to credit and helping build credit. And all of these are so foundational for consumers that are trying to live a better life. They're trying to climb a very broken wealth ladder and see a path towards greater control and stability. And ultimately, wealth creation is what we would like to see. So when we zoom out and look at the macro conditions, so you know those fundamentals, whether you're in a boom time or a stressed period of time, it doesn't really matter. It's about can you create that trusted relationship. Now where it does matter is that the economic situation changes for institutions. So in a rising rate environment, if you're a non-bank lender, you're going to feel a lot of pressure around funding costs. You're potentially going to start to see a wave of credit exposure, particularly if unemployment starts to tick up, which, you know, thankfully it's remained fairly resilient through this cycle, but we don't know what lies ahead. And so you're going to see a number of pressures in that regard. By being a bank, going back to the beginning of this conversation, you know, we are able to grow our lending business in a prudent way, but we're continuing to grow. It grew at over 300% last year with declining losses that can be funded off of sticky, stable deposits that are based on core primary banking relationships. And so I think different players are going to make different calculus in this changing environment. Now, you saw a couple players now who took some bets that did not play out, where they had excess surge deposits that came in on the back of, you know, IPOs and SPACs and big funding rounds and sort of the boom time in tech and made some bets by putting those deposits into long-dated securities and investments that rapidly lost value as interest rates rose. They were serving segments that could pull their money out quickly in a panic, and they did. And then we ended up where we are right now. So I think that, you know, for different players in the market, you know, risk management, prudent thinking, long-term kind of understanding the fundamentals of building trusted relationships are critically important.
You know, it's interesting because we talked about it before we got on the air, you know, this is where your history, your legacy of being a banker before being a digital banker or a startup really played well, because you don't lose sight of what banking's all about. And it helps you in these risky situations to know, geez, where can we get into trouble? Where would we maybe overplay our cards? But, you know, since we last talked, Varo has grown exponentially. Now, I believe it's exceeding 7 million accounts. That said, Varo has been challenged by a low average customer deposit level and account activity and an inability to expand relationships into meaningful credit relationships. What is Varo and what are you doing to increase scale and expand relationships so that you really have greater emphasis on the growth of the relationship as opposed to the actually opening up new accounts?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. And I think there's a few things. So one is, I wouldn't let call report data sort of like inform all the thinking because you know, customers use digital banking platforms for different use cases. And so you do have a number of customers that will open up accounts and they might put, you know, small dollar savings, or they might use it to access, you know, benefits in the marketplace that we have. And so things that, but you know, the core relationship customer that we have, we actually have been growing balances and we've been growing the stickiness of those relationships. And that is really our primary focus. And I think as you talk about how, you know, the twists and turns that come in the journey, I think we were playing a little bit of that game of grow at all costs, you know, back in the boom days in sort of 2021, where everybody was seeing this massive opportunity. There was a lot of funding in the market. And then so we started to dial up that growth engine. I think we pretty quickly realized that was probably not the smartest strategy, particularly as the funding markets were changing, the economic cycle was changing. And so we pulled way back. So we pulled our burn rate way back. We started to focus on on what we consider these high intent North Star customers. So these are these everyday consumers that are trying to solve some of these critical pain points that I talked about earlier, whether it's cash flow or it's building credit, building savings, accessing credit, and focusing on a suite of products that could be quite transformational in their lives. While we pulled back on sort of marketing and brand and you know, helping Mark Zuckerberg get richer and Facebook and things like that, like we really focused on the kind of core, you know, sort of what was going to matter to our customers and how to reach the most high intent customers. And that has been an incredibly successful strategy for us. So it's allowed us to greatly improve the unit economics of the business. You know, for those who diligently follow our call reports, you'll see that, you know, as we're getting closer to our path of profitability, that I think this is going to be a good year for us, as long as we stick to our knitting and focus on those core primary relationships and building the products and services that those customers want to improve their lives. And as I mentioned earlier, we actually have been expanding our lending. I think, you know, having had many years of experience doing this, you don't want to be sort of an overnight success. I think that hasn't worked out for some others that have gone, you know, full bore into building rapidly building a lending book without fully understanding the customer base and how to underwrite and how to extend credit. And so, you know, we started out with small dollar lending. We added secured lending. We're expanding limits, and we've got a number of things in our roadmap. But to build a lending business is a multi-year journey, and you want to do it prudently. And for us, and this is again a strategic choice that's probably based on a lot of years of experience, you know, we see ourselves as a relationship lender. So as we get to know our customers, we understand their capacity to repay and to handle debt, then we can extend more credit to them. But we want to do it in a prudent way so that we don't take a lot of that sort of volatility and credit loss that can happen, particularly as you're navigating through an uncertain economic cycle. And so we're doing it in a prudent way, but definitely it's in our plans and leveraging our charter. And it's also part of how we ultimately get to profitability as we continue to expand not just the core customer base, but the products that we can offer them.
Well, it's interesting, Colin, because you serve a very unique market that hadn't been well served by traditional banking. During a down or an uncertain economic environment, certainly the access to credit becomes in some ways greater, but it also becomes less or more risky. How do you see Varo expanding the credit relationships? And how do you currently expand the relationships while still keeping the fraud risk and delinquencies low?
Yeah, great question. So when you're in an economic cycle like this, particularly that's probably most pronounced by rising inflation. So everything is more expensive. You know, the basket of groceries, the tank of gas, your rent. You know, so everything starts to become more stretched, particularly for consumers that are just trying to make ends meet in the first place. And so to your point, having products and services that help lower cost, that help extend the sort of bridge financing to get to that next paycheck. We also offer, job opportunities in our app so folks can supplement their income if they're having some cash flow challenges with a number of job opportunities. So there's a number of ways in which we are helping to meet the consumer's need during this period of, you know, probably heightened economic stress for folks that are that are living paycheck to paycheck. Now, how do you do that prudently without taking undue risk and being able to manage, as you say, kind of both the credit as well as the fraud risk? And I think this is, again, built on, you know, a bit of a legacy of experience in terms of how do you get to know these customers? How do you measure the capacity? Because you don't want to extend credit to folks that are just not going to have the capacity to repay that. So this is where the relationship-based lending approach is very important. And it's also part of how we have successfully been able to contain fraud exposure as well, is by really understanding our customers, but in a digital context. Because in the old days, you used to be able to look someone across the face because they're sitting in a banking hall and right. You knew where they lived and you knew their children and you knew their families. And so now we have to do that in a digital context. context. But fortunately, technology has given us the tools to be able to really understand someone's identity, understand their situation, understand their cash flows, to be able to make smart decisions that are extraordinarily helpful for the customer, particularly in this time of economic stress, but also allows us to perform well as a financial institution.
It's interesting, you know, when we talked 3 years ago, and you mentioned it also, that it was really about growing the customer base. It was about trying to see how many new customers you can get. And we know in the banking industry and in any industry, really, just because you build it doesn't mean people will come. I mean, it's not Field of Dreams here. So, you know, you recently made some significant cuts in traditional marketing as well as some other modest cuts in your overall staff to make the model work a little bit better. How will Varo, and how is Varo currently supplementing that in maybe the way you're doing marketing, the way you're acquiring customers, the way you're growing customer base to continue to grow?
Yeah, there's really a few avenues by which customers discover us and engage with us and then ultimately make the decision to make Varo their primary bank. And so the first is what we call sort of organic acquisition. So this is where folks are just out on the internet, they're looking for banking solutions, they're trying to solve a particular problem, they hear about us and they come to our website or they download our app and then they ultimately decide to join. And that's been a real high growth part of our business, is just as we've gained awareness and you know, we've won a number of awards. We've got a 4.9 rating in the Apple App Store. We've got a 4.7 rating in the Google Play Store. We've got one of the highest NPS scores in the industry. So there's, you know, people find out and then they tell their friends and they kind of go through that discovery process. The other is, you know, we do continue to do some paid acquisition activity. I mean, much less so than what we had been doing kind of in the really heightened period of marketing spend. But we look at the most cost-efficient avenues to acquire high-intent customers. And also we have some very skilled modelers that are helping build tools to really bring in those best customers. We also have a pretty robust referral program within our customer base. So our customers are real advocates for the program. It's part of why we kind of get some of that recognition from, whether it's through NPS or reviews or through just more public recognition. And so those programs also create a healthy stream of customer acquisition. And then we have a number of great partners as well, that, you know, partners that might be in the kind of perks marketplace within the app, other partners that we work with from a content perspective that also just help spread the word. And we've got a pretty active social media presence that helps to connect with the customers we're serving and sharing customer stories and talking about things that are highly relevant to the customers that we're trying to do our best to help improve their lives and empower them financially. And I think that's been quite successful for us.
You know, it's interesting, since COVID, you know, back when we first talked, I should say, very few traditional financial institutions had significant digital banking success. Well, that's changed at almost every institution, as we realize the impact of digital on everybody's life and the way the consumer's reacting to digital engagement. What has been the major impact on your business plan with regard to how the marketplace has responded to what were digital-only banks?
Well, I think there's been a real enthusiastic adoption of digital banking solutions, particularly over the last few years, even, you know, since you and I last spoke. And I'd say this has been going on for probably, you know, 3 or 4 years now, where there's just been a lot more awareness of both, you know, whether it's, you know, the digital banking solutions with the incumbents or some of these more pure players like ourselves and others, that there's more kind of awareness that you can do all of your banking online and that you can do it all on your phone and it's with you 24/7. And I think that adoption has certainly manifested in statistics that you can see across the industry. And I don't think that's going to change, because you have also this generational shift where you've got got now, you know, Gen Zs and millennials who were basically born with a phone in their hand. And you know, to them, it would be anathema to drive up and go to a bank branch and, you know, find parking and sit there for an hour filling out forms and say, you know, you can do all of this in minutes on your phone. And then you can have this with you all the time. And so I think there's that generational shift. I think just technology has evolved to provide quality services for consumers. Now, that all being said, I think we go back to the fundamentals of trust. And so one of the dynamics that you do see playing out, particularly, I think, in this sort of neobank space, is that these consumers that are switching and they're exploring tend to open up multiple accounts. And so you do see scenarios where there's folks out there that have accounts with a number of the different providers. And then it's ultimately, you know, where do they feel they're getting the best service, they're getting the best value, and they have the highest level of trust that they ultimately decide that they're going to put their direct deposit and they're going to make it their primary banking account. And I think that is where we have a distinct advantage because we are a real bank. So we are a nationally regulated bank with FDIC insurance, with our deposits sitting at the Federal Reserve. And so like then it becomes, then it really is like, well, where do I want to take my bet as a consumer? I love the fact that I have these options and that there's a number of digital solutions that can meet my needs, but then it ultimately boils down to trust and safety.
So let's take a short break here and recognize the sponsor of this podcast. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Microsoft. See how Microsoft can help unlock new opportunities at speed and scale through innovative business processes, delivering differentiated customer experiences across channels, innovating new products and services, and redefining new ways of thinking. Find out more at Microsoft.com/financial services. So welcome back to Banking Transformed. I am joined today by Colin Walsh, founder and CEO of Varo. We have been discussing Varo's response to the challenging competitive marketplace and the economic forces, as well as the banking forces that are in play today. So, Colin, do you foresee the greatest competition going forward coming from other challenger banks, the big tech providers, or maybe just the everyday traditional banking organizations? And how do you set yourselves apart in your customer's mind from these organizations?
That's a great question, Jim. And so I think if I look at different sort of fields of competition, the traditional banks, it was interesting on my ride in a Lyft down to the office this morning, I heard a commercial from one of the big incumbent banks advertising 2-day early paycheck. And I was thinking, well, you're about 5 years late to the party on that one. But you know, at least I'm glad to see that others are trying to offer customers earlier access to their pay. But you know, I do think that the incumbents have made multiple attempts to try to kind of offer some of the services and create digital standalones. Those have not all been terribly successful. And I think there's other sort of more foundational issues that we've talked about in the past in terms of, you know, channel conflict, product silos, economic issues around serving a mass market customer base. And so I think that, you know, they're going to continue to try to do this, but it really isn't, you know, the mass market sort of everyday hardworking American consumer is not their core focus. And so I think that, you know, while the incumbents, you can't take your eye off them. And now that we are a real bank, you know, I think we're probably more kind of directly competing with a number of them. I feel like there's still lots of fairway for a player like ourselves. I think that the challenger banks are going to be challenged so in this environment, because I do feel like you'd have to have a fairly rich and broad-based product offering to make the economics work in the long run. And, you know, we talked a little bit about lending and kind of the path towards growing a lending book. I think deposit gathering is also something that requires, you know, skill and attention and what you do with those deposits and that you don't just go put them off in risky assets and other things. And so I think there's a lot of things that are just inherent limitations in the challenger sponsor bank model in terms of what are all the levers that can be pulled. And I think with funding more scarce and interest rates certainly creating some challenges for some of the lenders, I think that's going to be an interesting space to watch. So then you asked about the sort of the big tech players. I do think that you have some that are going to continue to look for more embedded finance solutions. They're going to look at opportunities in payments. They may find some interesting opportunities in lending, particularly some of the tech players that have large merchant bases. But I don't know that I see the big tech companies ever wanting to become directly regulated banks. So it's a space to watch, but I'd rather probably see them playing in the periphery and in certain areas where they can monetize and deepen the relationships with their core customer business, core customer segments and core business. But I don't necessarily see them jumping into the fray. So when I look around and assess that, I'd say this is an amazing opportunity for players like ourselves if you have to continue to do things the right way and focus on those core banking relationships and bringing the products that customers want. But I do think the competitive space is evolving and will continue to evolve over these next few years.
You know, you have a new unit called Varotech that's really been tasked with executing your overall growth strategy. Could Varo use this technology platform to become a provider of technology to the traditional banking industry?
Yeah. I wouldn't rule it out, but it's not a strategy for us right now. I mean, it's been hugely successful for us in terms of the pace at which we've been able to bring new features, new design systems, more sophisticated modeling techniques into Varo. So if you just look back over the last 6 months, I mean, we revamped our savings proposition. We opened up Zelle, which has been hugely popular to our customers. We've increased our lending limits. We've launched a new design system. We're about to launch a new website. Like all of these things are enabled through the kind of integration of these functions in this Varotech, which is more of an operating unit that is trying to create much more cross-functional, high collaboration, operating much more like a tech company. So now could we then say, is there a way to sort of make some of this available to others? I don't see it as something that we would pursue in the near term. You know, possibly someday there could be some value there, but we've got so much runway right now just doing what we're doing with the massive TAM of consumers that we can potentially serve that I think it would be, in my view at least, not the best way to direct our energy and attention.
You know, we talk about all this strategy and the fluidness of the marketplace, even as I mentioned in the last few days. Do you see a scenario where Varo could be acquired as a digital banking unit of a traditional banking organization or another fintech firm? And or alternatively, could Varo actually be in a buyer's position like a few of our fintech competitors have done?
It's a great question. So first of all, The former, I don't have a lot of appetite for. The latter, you know, could we be more of a consolidator at some point? You know, I think for right now, we're very focused on, you know, kind of getting to profitability, continuing to scale with the core segments that we serve, you know, delivering real innovation and product features and products that materially move the needle for our customers. And I think that's our prime focus. But, you know, at some point, could there be an opportunity to embrace partnerships or start to think about consolidation opportunities? You know, that to me feels more like something that would be of interest and you know, but I do feel like we've got some road to what's the right expression? There's road to hoe in front of us over certainly as we're getting through this economic cycle.
What has been interesting from an observer's point of view in the last 5 to 7 years is that so many companies came into the space, in the banking space, in one way or the other, in a specialized and non-specialized basis, some looking more like traditional banks, others looking like specialty providers. But, you know, to say the least, banking's a tough industry. We don't have to go very far to see organizations that have thought that they could put this together. Some are very big players, such as, you know, Marcus, that all of a sudden realize it's just not playing out the way we envisioned. What major trends do you see that may positively or negatively impact Varo in the near to medium term future?
Well, some of the things that we've been talking about, like right now, the rising rate environment is actually helpful for us in the sense that, we have a lot of our money sitting at the Fed, and now it's earning a spread and so it's generating a source of income. It's also very safe. And so I think that is certainly one area. I think that our ability to leverage those deposits to expand lending in a prudent way is also an advantage when others are going to be struggling to be able to extend their lending program. So I think those are some of the positives. I'd say that, we on the kind of headwind side, there are changes that are occurring, in terms of the funding environment. We're fortunate to have, great backers who have huge conviction on our business, and they see the promising future ahead. So I think that is something that, will certainly impact everyone. But, we have to make prudent decisions and choices and trade-offs. And, as you brought up earlier, like, would we want to go out and, we're not going to go on a big buying spree? Because I think there's just... there's going to be capital constraints that we just have to be pragmatic about. And I do think the broader, more existential piece that we have to be very mindful of is just the trust in the system. And I feel like the system worked as designed when these players started to come under intense pressure and the FDIC stepped in. And then the Fed and the Treasury, were decisive and acted quickly to bring stability to the system. And I think that was incredibly helpful and kind of things worked as designed. But I do feel that, that is something that has caused consumers and businesses and others to sort of like pay attention. And I think that now it's really up to players like ourselves to continue to demonstrate that we have, the effective risk management. We've got the right products. We're creating the value. We're making the right decisions on behalf of our consumers to protect their money. And I think every participant in the system has to be thinking very deeply about, how they continue to earn and sustain that trust, because that's what this banking system is all about. And it is hard. And I think many have learned that you can't just sort of do this. You can't be fly by night. You can't just sort of wing it. I mean, this requires a lot of very careful, thoughtful decision making every day that you can demonstrate to your consumers or whoever your customer segments are that they can trust to that you're going to protect their money.
So, in a kind of a broad sense, one thing that I believe I've seen in the last week, and I mentioned this on a BBC interview I did over the weekend, is that, does this really, more than just the impact on a singular unit or the tech community overall, will this impact in one way or the other the appetite for investment in fintech and tech firms, at least in the near term, based on what has happened in a reevaluation of the risk involved in financing the financial services community?
Well, I think that there will always be money available for good players. So with sound business models that, maybe they're, either they are generating strong returns or they have a clear path to generate strong returns. They're serving large segments of the market and have the potential to serve large segments. So I do think that there will be funding available. However, I think that investors are going to be far more discerning about where they place their bets and where they put their capital. And so they will want to see the evidence of traction. They'll want to see sustainability. So it's a little less around, can you create a whizzy new idea that's going to attract a bunch of low engagement customers? I mean, those days are over. And so businesses that thought that they could show a bunch of vanity metrics and attract a lot of funding are going to struggle for sure. And I think that is part of the reevaluation that's happening, in the investment community right now.
So two more questions. The first of which is, over the last 2 years since we last talked, what surprised you the most in a positive sense, and what surprised you the most in a in somewhat of a negative sense with regard to building Varo?
Yeah, I would say the one of the most rewarding and pleasing aspects of this journey has been the people inside of Varo and the resilience and the commitment to building something that has an that has the potential to impact millions of people's lives in a profoundly positive way in terms of trying to climb a broken wealth ladder, create more wealth equity in this country, building a platform that has all the foundational elements to help consumers achieve more resiliency. And these are big societal issues that we're solving, and the grit and tenacity and excitement and curiosity by which this team has embraced that challenge has been incredibly rewarding. And so I would say that has been, certainly very exciting for me as a leader to see that culture. And, and then also we stamp our whole mission is about expanding inclusivity and opportunity. And even inside our company, we have 7 employee resource groups for a small company. We celebrate the diversity of our employee base. We had a Diwali celebration in the office back in November, something we used to do before COVID, and like things that just there's a real sense of belonging and that we're all trying to solve some very big problems. And so I think that that has been wonderful. I'd say some of the harder things, and again, it's always gut-wrenching as a founder to have to let people go, like last year when we had to do that. And, having to, I think we're quite a pragmatic group in terms of, fairly seasoned. We've been through multiple cycles, and you sort of see like, okay, well, maybe we scaled too fast and now we have to pull back and we have to take sort of a longer term view. And I think that the decision-making process was probably less challenging. It's just the then having to go make all those changes and make them quickly. I mean, we kind of pivoted on a dime. When you think about like we were, full steam ahead 1 minute, and the next minute we're like, okay, marketing is down 80%, and we're gonna take the steps we have to take, and being able to have the flexibility that the business model afforded us to do that. Because I mean, I think back to my days of some of the other institutions that I'd worked at, it would be very, very difficult to introduce so much change into the business so quickly. But we did that, but it's hard, and that's always has, it takes a toll as you're sort of moving through these different cycles, but it's part of how you win in the long run is you sort of adapt to your reality.
Colin, it's interesting. I remember our first conversation vividly. Your energy and enthusiasm when we first talked was really your calling card and actually made the interview so popular on our platform. In fact, it's still getting a lot of listens every week. The video also has in it, and it's interesting to see how, given all the change, all the things you had to do that were difficult, but also, as you mentioned, your employee relationships and your vision, it is still shows through. And as I mentioned before our podcast, when I do my presentations internationally, I refer to you as being, one of these traditional bankers that decided to branch out into something new. And that if you don't have leadership that provides the vision, the enthusiasm, the experience of what banking really is, you'll be lost. And I think it really, again, sets you apart and your organization apart from a lot of traditional financial institutions, as well as fintech firms that may have not had all the experience they needed during the toughest times. I really appreciate your time again today. I know it's a very busy time for everybody, and maybe something's happened since our podcast went, we did the recording.
Let's
here.
Hope but not.
Yeah, I definitely hope not. Or maybe something positive. But it's a challenging time. And I think, again, your positive attitude is really a big asset for an organization that's still very much in the growth mode. So thank you again for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's been great chatting with you, and look forward to more of these conversations.
Thanks for listening to Banking Transform, the winner of 3 international awards for podcast excellence. We appreciate your support and hope you can find time to show some love in the form of a positive review. Finally, Be sure to catch my recent articles on the financial brand and check out our research in the Digital Bank Report. This has been a production of Evergreen Podcast. A special thank you to our senior producer, Leah Haslidge, audio engineer, Sean Rule Hoffman, and video producer, Will Pritz. I'm your host, Jim Marus. Remember, challenges are always part of the future. The key is to prepare for what may be ahead and view challenges as opportunities for learning and growth.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.